Brother David, he was a preacher in 1816, 1853. Vigorous, intense, down to earth, his sermons were widely published. In his day, they thought whiskey was a stimulant. And before he went into the pulpit, he always took a small glass of whiskey. I don't recommend that.
They have a new paperback of his stuff out. Have you seen it?
No, I haven't.
There's a new paperback, so you don't have to buy the four volumes or the other. And we have it in the library. This is for, if you've never, how many of you have never read his sermons? He's my favorite preacher.
Yeah.
Well, he writes like modern architecture. That's why he's still modern.
Yeah.
I mean, the guy always, it's a sermon sentence you can split.
Mm-hmm.
And you could never, anyone who heard him would be able to tell you what he preached about. You know, question about the what, because when you're through, it's there.
Mm-hmm.
It's there. I always say, like, it's there. It's got two parts, and you can do this.
And his sermons are such that you could preach it today.
That's right.
Yeah. Fred Robertson. When you mentioned Hoimy from Eau Claire, his sermons are much the same way. He was the man that was born 50 years too soon.
And in the wrong language.
Yeah. If he had been today, he'd been a powerful preacher, one of the greatest.
You want to hear somebody preach that I like to marry? My wife, this is why I want her to preach, because she just makes the pastors feel good. She's got much the same gift. But on this Frederick W. Robertson, I have compared him in a paper to Nietzsche and Kierkegaard, because he's much the same spirit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what was going on, he could see, he had a bourgeoisie congregation, middle class, he could see the decadence at work in it, and he was fighting to put this new salt, new life in, with the word of God, he's fasting. I like Phillips Brooks, like you mentioned, but boy, we're against him.
Mm-hmm.
Robertson just stands out.
Phillips Brooks was he was speaking to the cultured, aristocratic Boston audience. His audience was a difficult audience to speak to, but he certainly held them.
At the same time, all the way, even when he was in Philadelphia earlier and in New York.
Yes.
And he had the same types in all three congregations that he had.
I think his father was a Unitarian and his mother an Episcopalian, and they both influenced him very strongly. His father was a great scholar. He said later on in life, he said his father's faith had a great influence on him. He said when the adversity and loss and trouble, he said his father said, we've had good times and unpleasant times, but the Lord is with us in all these. I spoke Sunday evening at a meeting, and I used this illustration of Brooks' life. He had the habit of going down the street, which many of our ministers in early days did. I remember Dr. Stubb, my predecessor in Stoughton, used on Saturday night walk up and down the streets to greet the farmers that were in town. Brooks used to go in an area in Boston which was the worst and the most terrible section, called Rotten Row. And on a very gloomy, nasty day, he'd walk down that street greeting everybody, hello, good morning. And the Boston Transcript, which no longer exists, but the newspaper at the time, said it was all gloomy in Boston, but it was sunshine in Rotten Row because Phillips Brooks walked down that street. Isn't that a tribute to a man? That's the kind of man he was.
Would you be bringing out at all this week the influence of Saturday night on Sunday morning that way? Because I just got a trip to him. I always walked around the block that was all taverns in Watertown every Saturday night after I'd had a men's Bible college before. Mm-hmm. I'd go home and read a short story of someone sitting along to get rid of all of my theological jargon. No, but my people, we started in Clear Lake one time after I preached a sermon. Some of my people came and said, you read a lot of German, so I said, how can you tell? I said, what are they problem? And what you've been reading recently tends to shape your Saturday night, I think it's got a lot to do with it.
I'm going to come into, when we come to sermon preparation and the background of the preparation, we'll have something to say on that score. Then there was the gentle S. Parks Cadman, quite a man, whose sermons don't read easily, very difficult to read. But it was my pleasure both to hear and meet him. His day, he was through in about 1925-30. I wanted to mention before this, however, the man that succeeded Beecher. His name was Newell Dwight Hillis, one of the best essay writers in our country. Newell Dwight Hillis was a scholar, an able preacher. But here's a little thing that's of interest. In 1912, he confessed to his people, to the whole congregation with tears, that he played the stock market with the church funds and lost the whole business, which was into the thousands, and sought the forgiveness of his congregation, which was given. During First World War, he was one of the most rabid anti-German speakers in our nation. He was in constant demand. One wonders whether it was not a psychological reaction from his exposure of his moral lapse that brought about this intense swing of feeling against the German people. I heard him at a Chautauqua meeting. Man, he just about wanted to get out of your chair and rush over and kill every German you saw. He was that killer. Moving into our own times, perhaps the most influential preacher in the first half of the century and on into the second, the first quarter of the second, was Harry Emerson Fosdick. For with him came a new type of preaching. Before his time, most preachers were the stentorian type. Fosdick fearlessly broke with the traditions of the past and began to preach sermons with not only a biblical setting, but also with a background of psychology, sociology, and an everyday approach to theology. I had him as a teacher one summer at Union Theological Seminary. Whatever may be the measure of Fosdick's preaching, he went where the people were. He always began where the people were. We may disagree with his solutions to the problems and his extremes of the 20s, for which he himself has retreated, but he started a tremendous movement in this country for preachers to take off their vestments, come out of the pulpit, sit down in the pews, and listen to the people before they prepare their sermons. I presume criticism, and you don't realize how heavy it was against him in the late 20s and early 30s. I can remember our Lutheran papers calling him the son of the devil and everything else. I presume criticism made of him that his feet were on the earth but his head was not in heaven may have some justification, but I think the Lord used him at a critical time in the history of preaching, and we turned the corner with him. From the time of Fosdick to the present time, the pulpits all over the country have felt his impact. All of you are familiar with his book, The Modern Use of the Bible, The Guide to Understanding the Bible, but the books I recommend, The Meaning of Faith, The Meaning of Service, and The Meaning of Prayer. These three books will remain classics in their particular area. The Meaning of Prayer. Much I could say here too. In the book, The Power to See It Through, we find such sermons as The High Use of Serenity, Basic Conditions of Spiritual Well-Being, The Ideas That Use Us, and these are some of his practical approaches. Names like Buttrick, Sachman, Holmes, McCartney, Lynn Herloff, Reinhold Niebuhr, Billy Graham, Walt, and the late Walter Meyer are some of the men of our generation. You've probably heard them all. I remember once Buttrick was asked in the preacher's meeting I was at, did you ever feel that you should join any lodge? One fellow said, I'm a Mason, I think it helps. Well, he said, I'm not an elk or an eagle nor an ass, he said. he said that he didn't see that it was any help. Billy Graham follows in the tradition of Billy Sunday, Moody, Spurgeon, and Whitfield. I did have a paragraph about Whitfield in here too by George Whitfield, Days of Benjamin Franklin. Benjamin Franklin suggested that the two of them go out to the state of Ohio and take it over and run it. He take the religious part, and Benjamin Franklin take the political part. They didn't come to it. But Benjamin Franklin used to go and listen and preach. His sermons, with small variation, read very much like Spurgeon Moody, referring to Billy Graham. It's about Billy Graham, freshness, sincerity. He's handsome, captures and holds the attention of the multitude. Many of you perhaps know him personally. It's too soon to measure the permanence of his influence. It's hard to say whether this will last or not, whether it's just a part of the times and the restlessness of our times. He spoke to a million people in England. I wrote a letter to him when he spoke in England and received a very nice answer. Incidentally, I met with him and a few others when I was in Minneapolis. I think he was going to approach me to come and be with him. And I complimented him on his good work, but I said, I am brought up under a totally different tradition. I said, I'm a Lutheran in my bones, and I'm I emphasize teaching. My ministry is a teaching type of ministry. Yours is very good. It has its effect. But I couldn't be that type of preacher, just as perhaps you couldn't be my type of a preacher. I said, the Lord uses all of us in different ways. But I've always felt he's sincere. Though they use all the organized machinery of a theater, and everything is a bit theatrical, and yet it amazes me how humble the guys remain. He's been kings and queens and presidents, and how many of us would remain as humble as he has if we had as much public attention as he has received? I'm sure not many of us would have that grace of God. I don't see him very often. Once in a while I bump into him. But if he sees me in a crowd, he rush up and grab my hand, calls him by name. Now, how he can remember me and how he can be that humble is difficult. Very seldom does he take to task preachers. He always seeks the church. He's not like Billy Sunday, who used to lambast the churches. But I think that Billy Graham is a freshness that is valuable. The one thing I'm opposed to is people coming up out of the big crowd to make testimony.
I'm just going to say that's what I can't take. And I wrote him on that.
Did you?
Didn't come back at it. I said, no, he had a perfect sermon on hell. It was great. And it would have been an ideal one for him to say that those of you who don't want to be in the dark, go out into the outer darkness. You know?
Yeah.
And the rest remain. I said, no, why don't you use the fellowship of the church instead of isolating and bringing him up? Of course, you know the answer. This is his public image, and that's that's his advertising. Without that, where would he be?
When I was in Minneapolis, I got 60 names of people who had been to his meetings and said that they were interested in Central Lutheran Church to become members of it. I very carefully screened every one of them because I wanted to test. I had a committee and I had people working on it. We called on every single one of them. We only got 3 that came into the church. Now, of those 3, they would have come in anyhow. The rest of them said, I don't know what happened to me. I don't know why I went to the meeting. I'm not interested. I was carried away by the emotions. Only 3 out of the 60. Well, now that is towards the beginning. I'm sure this is no measure of it at all. No test of it at all. But this is the danger that happens. Now just imagine. Here's a guy that's very ordinary clerk in a store. He's in an audience of 25,000 people. And Billy Graham says, come forward. For 1 minute, anyhow, this one man has 25,000 people looking at him. He'll never have an opportunity in life like that again to be the center of attention. So to me, it is a playing on the emotions and a deadly thing.
What percentage do you think of those who come forward perhaps have been raised, they've had that in their background someplace, of doing this, of coming forward, say, at the end of the service?
Mm-hmm.
What percentage do you think? I wonder if there's anything at all along the line like that.
I don't know. I've never, any of you, any figures?
Well, I suspect there's an awful lot of them because I saw him in operation last Friday night down in Portland.
Is that so?
And there was not, it seemed like there wasn't, unless I'm used to Billy Graham now, was not the emotionalism there was 18 years ago or so when it was in Minneapolis. That just the simple announcement, they started streaming in. One of our couples went Saturday night with some Baptist friends. And they are used to this business, the altar call, you know. And they had little girls four in the fourth and fifth grade or so. And the little girls wanted to go down, see. And the parents said no, because they wanted to get out and get home, you know, and get ready for Sunday school the next day and so forth. They didn't want them lost in the crowd. The little girls both cried, because this was their heaven,
yeah,
their way of offering. I just wonder if anyone have a guess on that. How many are used to it?
Yeah.
It's just a thing to do, see, just like on a communion Sunday.
Well, maybe we stayed Lutherans, particularly Norwegians, who are so unemotional. This almost looks like hypocrisy to us, while they in turn look upon us some wooden people without any feeling.
We had 47 names that were given to our congregation in Seattle when he was there, and we also contacted all 47. And our score was 0.
Is that so?
And we got a lot of interesting reactions as to why they had gone down there.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that disturbed me was that I was at some of the services, and I think the messages are certainly scriptural.
Yes.
We can't get away from that. But encouraging people to go down to the tent. They had ushers that were constantly watching for these people, it seems to us, that they may have had some tears or they're scared to death because he did use the scare tactic.
Yes, he did.
There.
Yeah.
You better do this because you're going to go on the highway tonight and you never know what might happen. And this was very sad that he should use that. The other thing was that the result of the actual help to our parish, after he had been there for 6 weeks in Seattle, I spent the next 6 months counseling these people.
Exactly.
That had been there. And they had lost sight of their baptism, they had lost sight and they were shook. And one of the things that shook some of these dear ladies particularly was the fact that they hadn't gone down the Sawdust Trail, and maybe they should have given their witness.
Yeah.
I just can't figure the thing out.
It is. Because of this, of course, we Lutherans have shied away from the word commitment and giving oneself to Christ or being born again. With discomfort, we use these phrases because we immediately envision that emotional approach. And yet there is such a thing as commitment, as we know. And there is such a thing as being born again. On the other hand, there are these people that want to state a specific Saturday afternoon at 4 o'clock, I became a Christian. Well, I said to one woman, I can't tell you when I loved my mother or my mother loved me. I have no specific date, but I know I always loved my mother and that she loved me. But there, I can't point to any time or place. And I said, so it is with us born into the Christian church through baptism. In the grace of God, we can't point to any time. We just know that he's always been there and that's it. But on the other hand, there are people who go through life and have had no commitment to Christ and make an about face. And we have to, within Lutherans, perhaps recapture some of that.
It's hard you didn't mention anything, or were you going to mention anything about Moody? Now, I realize Moody certainly can't be classified as a great preacher.
Yes.
But he certainly was a man that reached people in a way that very few people ever have in the history of our country.
Now, a reason I slipped over that, because I figure Moody was a more familiar figure with most everybody. And he was certainly a down-to-earth sort of a man and tremendous love of people. And he could appeal to the intellectual as well as the humblest. Sir Wilbur Grenfell, who did the great work in the Labrador regions, got started due to Moody, listening to him, tremendously impressed by it. The fact is, I think it was in this meeting where Grenfell was influenced, where there's a man getting up and making a long, long prayer and going on, and Moody stepped up. He saw this man, young Grenfell, come in, and Grenfell was about to turn and go. And Moody stepped up and said, while the man finishes his prayer, we'll sing him so-and-so. And as a result, appeal to Grenfell.
Another question comes to my mind with Wesley, and now you say with Moody, that out of these came what we would usually call now social action. Now, are we so social action-minded through government and philanthropic organizations, so forth and so on, that there is much room for, say, Billy Graham's crusades to spawn so-called social action? Because I don't know of anything in terms of lifting the poor and the dispossessed as a direct result of Graham, whereas in those others you can spawn.
I think you're
That's
right.
What I've been told, at least.
Of course, the level of intellect of a community in the United States today is much higher than England was in the days of John Wesley. And John Wesley, as many of you know, was a highly educated man and highly respected by the leaders in business and industry, so that he was the intellectual equal of almost anybody in his day. It was a totally different, and he had a profound love. And the vast difference between the masses and the group up here was vastly different than in our own country today. But as an aside here, what is the function of Lutheran welfare or Lutheran hospitals or Lutheran colleges or Lutheran schools? We can't educate everybody. What then is our function? What is the function of our colleges I have an answer for that, which satisfies me, but I'll give it to you later. I want to finish this, because I think you'd enjoy it. There are many others in this hasty survey which could have been mentioned and given, like Guthrie, Chapman, Fowler, Birrell. If you're in different denominations, these, Russell Connell. Did any of you ever hear Russell Connell who wrote Acres of Diamonds? I was a student at St. Olaf College when he came and spoke to the students in 1915, 16. Gave his talk, The Acres of Diamonds. Marvelous man. He was in the Civil War. His main bodyguard, Johnny Ring, was killed. And this man said, I must live two lives. I must live his life as well as my own. He founded Temple University, Russell Connell did, and exerted a great influence in the area. James Buckley, Charles Hodge, Presbyterians would quote him, Marshall, as you know, the man, Peter Marshall, Chappelle, Paul Scherer, Stewart. Any of you know Paul Scherer?
Yeah.
I roomed right next to him at Union Theological Seminary when he was lecturing. I read his books and had a great admiration for him, but when I visited them, as cold as this table. No warmth or feeling at all. A feeling I was talking to a machine, cultured, refined machine. At the same time, we had Ralph Sockman. Ralph Sockman, Methodist, warm, delightful fellow, went down and saw his new church. It was being built in the process. Wife and I went down, looked at it, came in, and I just said, I'm a minister from studying at Union, and I like your lectures and want to see your church. He spent an hour taking us through the church, climbing up the steps and talking about it, as warm and democratic as could be. Now, here, one suspects that at times that much of the preaching in the past was not to audiences very critical, so people could get by with something. I like this description John Rice makes of his uncle, who is a preacher. John Rice, a retired famous preacher now in Detroit. He said to listen to him, his uncle, was like quietly getting drunk. He led his hearers by easy stages into an unreal world of effortless peace, drugging them gradually into unconsciousness by the melody that was himself. They went home to eat their Sunday dinners in dazed silence and remained befuddled until Monday morning. When they woke up and went about their business. One wonders about Victor Hugo's description of Napoleon. Hugo said of Napoleon, he embarrassed God. Now, in summary, what are the characteristics of all the men who have been great preachers? First of all, emotional intensity. They've shouted, they may have been talking peacefully, but there was emotional intensity about them. It was physical appearance of the man, his voice, his vigorous manner of speaking, but always there was the contagious urgency in the message, whether it's the culture of Phillips Brooks or Billy Graham, what have you, that they would make people feel this is important. Sir, come down ere my child die, is what the man said to Jesus. These men drew large crowds and they had the capacity to stir up the emotions of people. This is the first thing, the emotional intensity. And that's why it's so important for ministers to be in good health physically. Preaching is very exhausting. I heard Fosdick say to us in class, preaching for 1 hour is equal to the energy spent in pitching hay all day. Second, these men had strong egos. Now, that is not the same as conceit. Conceit to say I'm better than anybody else. Ego is a sense of I want to be out in the center of the stage. I got to be the general. And this is true of us men, the male of the species. I hate to admit it, but the women present. But the male of the species wants to be senator, governor, preacher, superintendent, principal, boss, general. He's a strong ego. Martin Luther had it. So did Apostle Paul, Abraham Lincoln. You know what, Abraham Lincoln, when the tall man came to his office, he'd go and step alongside him and see if he was taller. Oh, yeah, that good sense of humor with him. That saved him. To puncture his own pomposity. I think when a man approached Lincoln for a job to be one of these porters in front of the hotel or the White House in uniform, Lincoln had the time of his life with him. He said, "Have you read any books on how to be a porter? Have you taken any courses in school?" And the man says, "No, Al." He said, "Well, I guess I can't take the job," the man said. He delighted in these particular ways of handling situations. They could be learned or limited in their education, but they had a particular drive to them. Three, though doctrinally most of them were conservative, whether conservative or liberal, they were seldom heavy-footed in the area of dogma. If they preached dogma, they didn't come down with a sledgehammer. There were constantly two distinct, clear emphases. People are lost and people are saved in one way or another. They use the language of lost and redeemed. I preached a sermon once on lost and redeemed. It was published in the Pulpit magazine. I wonder if these two words or ideas have slipped out of the preaching of the day, lost and saved, one way or the other. I wonder if we aren't thinking of complexes, inferiority complexes, and so on. A man that had inferiority complex because he was inferior. When we study the modern preacher, we find that the same language that is in Fosdick as well as in others. He doesn't say lost or saved, he says making the best of a bad mess, or in finding people where they are. The fourth characteristic I noticed, another matter which we must keep in mind, the background must with these preachers, was that death was always just around the corner. Not for the preacher, but for the mass of people. They lived and preached to people who were always close to death. Up until 1910, funeral directors every year put in a supply of children's caskets, up until 1910. And when I began my ministry and talking to older people, they would tell me they lost two or three children through this disease or that disease or the other disease. And if you will take a church celebrating its 100th anniversary and go into the records and look and see the death of children, 5 years of age, 6 years of age, 10 years of age, you'd be amazed how much that must have entered into the preaching of there. Death was always present.
I was reading recently an article on the ethics of various organ transplants, heart, kidney, this type of thing. And along with this ethical question, they also brought up the fact that with this progress, there's becoming more and more of this feeling that death is something remote and far off to people. Because if I have something wrong with my heart, I have the valve replaced, or perhaps the whole heart, or my kidney, or these various things, which makes it even a little bit farther, I suppose. Maybe falls in line with what you were saying about science taking over.
Yeah. Someone else has to die to give me a new heart.
The pain. Yeah, we had a sad thing happen in my church. We have a huge cross, and you could never see it. It's on top of a tower, and then they had an aluminum cross that had discolored. It was too small, only 1.5 inches high on top of this huge tower, so you couldn't see. So we put a new cross up there, and the company that put it up, we enlarged the cross and surrounded the one that was there with a much larger cross, made it 3-4 times as big. But in welding the base of it, they hadn't gotten it firm enough, so the cross slightly tilted crooked. So we called the company just 2 weeks ago to come back and straighten up the cross. And the tragedy, though, was the man going up to straighten it up, the cable broke and he dropped and was killed. Dropped about 40 feet. It is a strange thought there, isn't it? Took death to put it up. A man died on the cross, so we have a cross. And it took death to straighten it out. A man dies to keep the cross straight in this world, as well as to put the cross up there to be. And this just happened in my church about 2 weeks ago. We're moving in a difficult time, and Judgment Day was always just around the corner in days gone by. Death was always there. Funerals are very common. This new age is going to be different, as you mentioned. I appeared in a program in St. Paul, Minnesota, with the State Medical Association, president of St. Thomas College, a rabbi and myself, on the implications of science morally in the future. Is it right to transplant from one to another if a man is going to shorten a man's life by 6 months, but lengthen another man's life by 10 years? Is it right to tell a man he's going to die from cancer, or should it be withheld from him? Is it right to prolong life with scientific equipment? It merely means he continues as a vegetable and the heart beats. These were questions put to us by doctors, for us three, to try to say, these are the thoughts of the clergy in this area in respect. Another question put to us now, how about 10, 20 years from now, when a woman who wants a baby goes into something almost like a supermarket, says, I want a baby that has dark hair and musically talented, of Caucasian blood, certain height. And she can go down and press the buttons like a computer, and out will come the ingredients necessary to produce that kind of a baby. And she will not even have to carry the baby inside her, that it will be put in an incubator, and the baby like that will be produced and born and reared and handed over to her. And here's the baby that you got through your computer. They said, this may come by the year 1920. Now, what are the moral and the spiritual implications? Incidentally, in the Borsoborsk in Russia, there's a tremendous university. They have over 12,000 students and professors studying in this very area of how to revamp the chromosomes of the human being so that you can produce whatever type of human being you want to produce. Tall, short, dumb, slave type of people, superior people, musical, talented, and it'll have nothing to do with the mother tongue. So you see, gentlemen, we have some problems to face. Well, the fifth thing I have here. Before our present period, the preacher did not have strong competition for attention. Man, I could put on a program at church in Eau Claire and we'd have 300 men come out for men's brotherhood. Try that today. Today there is radio, color television, the press, paperback, athletic contests, golf matches from all over the world on your TV every Sunday, a host of other forms of entertainment that draw crowds, which otherwise used to be the popular preacher's crowd. I remember in the army seeing a large crowd around a soldier. What was he doing? He was playing guitar and very poorly. But the moment we got better entertainment, he was left alone by himself. People went to the USO. And so the preacher, if he's purely entertainment, which many of them were, boy, they were colorful. Man, these old-time Lutheran preachers, I can remember some of them. Wow, they could put on a show. Long frock coat, ribbon tie, long hair, sometimes big hat. I can remember some of them, their stentorian voices. Now, as a boy, six, in the days gone by, there were no public address systems. There could be no large audience unless the speaker had a powerful voice and an impressive physical bearing. So that type of preacher became popular. Seven, in former days, more people took part in the service than today. In the fringe churches of today, we find participation. People brought their own hymn books to church. They memorized the hymns. They knew their Bible. They brought the Bibles to church. But today we have a floating population. In Central Lutheran Church, when I was a pastor there, I estimated that many Sundays, 60% of the people were visitors. Just in a sense, floating from place to place. 1967, 35% of the people in the United States moved from one place to another. And again, in my opinion, it's the theory that that preaching is today on a much higher level. We have many more good preachers, but whether we're equal to the times in which we live is another question. I give these five things which we'll go on into next after or tomorrow. One is to get attention, begin where the people are, keep moving, speak in a positive manner, and respect the backgrounds of your listeners. That's enough.
Very good. You have the afternoon off.